Blog Talk Radio.
What happens when the prostate enlarges? The urine channel gets tight. You have an enlarged prostate through this five.
Hi, this is Lionel Richie. What better time than now to remind us of a day more than
when
ever
we need to come together? When the world
on the 35th anniversary of the album, we'll remember what life really was.
There are people dying. Oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life.
We need a
first of
all.
Day by day, I bet the world somewhere will soon make a change. All about us, our family, and the truth, you know love is all we need.
There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's true, we make a better day, just you and me. Well, send them your heart.
There's a choice we're making.
So they know that someone's there.
Wait.
bless you as we come tonight of the Dr. Martin King Jr.
movement. Your dog might be cute,
what
and
I
you don't even know it.
You
but don't
tonight as you get ready to go. Don't forget, this is March. Archangel Michael is the angel this month. I want you to read for this month Psalm 1, chapter 1, Psalm chapter 2, Psalm chapter 3. This is the month of magic, the month of miracles. So if you got a need to plant a seed in our ministry, go to my website, The Seed of Abraham, yourself.com, hit PayPal. If you want to do cash out, put money sign, Bishop, and 3 keys, and go right to cash out. If you got a need tonight to plant your seed, we're going to hear from Dr. Martin Luther King, because this is Dr. Martin Luther King movement. They just were that Pettus Bridge down there marching. It's been 50 years since they called it Bloody Sunday. But my thing is, we need to stop the killers and save the babies. And what's going on? Babies killing babies. Mama killing babies. I want to say to the black community, the community at world, the world, stop the killing, save the babies. We got too many guns and bombs and too many forces to kill. But God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish, have everlasting life. I want you to get ready tonight to open up your heart and your mind to the power of God. I'm going to play a few records from Marvin Gaye saying what's going on and the floods, the storms, the cancer. It's all in the atmosphere. The lady was calling me, the bishop, you have prophesied for people to leave me alone because you're dealing with cancer and the different chemicals that you're using. They went down to Alabama, to Selma, to walk across the Pettus Bridge. That was happening in 50. They should have been in Ohio saying what we can do, these trains are wrecked, and the whole town is full of cancer. Fish is dying, animals dying. We got to put our resources at the right places. We are the people of the world. I want to tell you tonight, this is March, and on the first Monday in March, all is well. I'm praying for the people in California snowed in, praying for the people in Kentucky that had tornadoes. But I said in my prophecy, Jerry, it's coming back to man and woman straighten up their life and repent to God. And Dr. King even said that. Marcus Garvey said that. And anybody in the spiritual realm said that. I want to get ready to listen tonight. What's going on?
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
Hey, how you
doing? Man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and kiss here today. Oh, pick it light. Take it back. Don't punish me.
brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated
that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shut down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power. Yes.
All labor has dignity. But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
And I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to a group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight,
We don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want
to. It is always a rich and rewarding experience to take a brief break from our day-to-day demands and the struggle for freedom and human dignity and discuss the issues involved in that struggle with concerned friends of goodwill all over our nation. Certainly, it is always a deep and meaningful experience to be in a worship service. And so, for many reasons, I'm happy to be here today. I would like to use as a subject from which to preach this morning, remaining awake through a great revolution. Text for the morning is found in the book of Revelation. There are two passages there that I would like to quote. It's in the 16th chapter of that book. Behold, I make all things new. The former things are passed away. I'm sure that most of you have read that arresting little story from the pen of Washington Irving entitled Rip Van Winkle. The one thing that we usually remember about the story is that Rip Van Winkle slept 20 years. But that is another point in that little story that is almost always completely overlooked. It was a sign in the end from which Rip went up in the mountain for his long sleep. Rip Van Winkle went up in the mountain. The sign had a picture of King George III of England. When he came down 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the first president of the United States. Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, but in looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountains, a revolution was taking place and at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through a revolution. One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. There can be no gain sensing of the fact that a great revolution has taken place in the world today. In the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. And that is a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then that is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place. That is still the voice crying through the vista of time, saying, behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new challenges and new opportunities. I would like to deal with the challenges that we face today as a result of this triple revolution that is taking place in the world today. First, we are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. And anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. The challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has come into being to a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in change. Our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood. And yet, we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. Somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. But whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is. This is the way it's structured. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island in time itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We must see this, believe this, live by it. If we are to remain awake for a great revolution. Secondly, we are challenged to eradicate last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that Racial injustice was still the black man's burden, white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle, sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. I can see nothing more urgent for America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. Everyone must share in the guilt, individuals and as institutions. Government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact. 7 o'clock on Sunday morning, when we stand to sing, in Christ there is no east nor west. We stand in the most segregated hour of America. The hour has come for everybody, for all institutions, the public sector and the private sector, work to get rid of racism. Now, if we're to do it, we must honestly admit certain things and get rid of certain myths that have constantly been disseminated all over our nation. One is the myth of time. It is a notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. There are those who often sincerely say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, why don't you slow up? Stop pushing things so fast. Only time can solve the problem. And if you will just be nice and patient and continue to pray, for 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. That is an answer to that myth. It is a time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. I'm sorry to say this morning that I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous of our nation, the people on the wrong side, have used time much more effectively the forces of goodwill. It may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the patriotic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability, comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. Without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time realize that the time is always right to do right. Now that is another myth that still gets around. It is a kind of over-reliance on the bootstrap philosophy. There are those who still feel that if the Negro is to rise out of poverty, the Negro is to rise out of slum conditions. He is to rise out of discrimination and segregation. He must do it all by himself. And so they say the Negro must lift himself by his own bootstraps. They never stopped to realize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. The people who say this never stopped to realize that the nations made the black man's color a stigma. But beyond this, they never stopped to realize the debt that they owe people who were kept in slavery 244 years. 1863, the Negro was told that he was free as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed by Abraham Lincoln. But he was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. It was something like keeping a person in prison for a number of years and suddenly discovering that that person is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. Just go up to him and say, now you're free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get some clothes to put on his back or to get on his feet again in life. Every code of jurisprudence will rise up against this. Yet this is the very thing our nation did to the black man. It simply said, you're free. And it left him there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. The irony of it all is that at the same time, the nation failed to do anything for the black man. Through an act of conscience, it was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land grant colleges, teach them how to farm. Not only that, it provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, the years unfolded, it provided low interest rates so that they could recognize their farms. And to this day, thousands of these very persons are receiving billions of dollars in federal subsidies every year, not the farm. And these are so often very people tell Negroes that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. It's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. We must come to see that the roots of racism are very deep in our country. And there must be something positive and massive in order to get rid of all of the effects of racism. The tragedies of racial injustice. Now that is another thing closely related to racism that I would like to mention as another challenge. We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world. 2/3 of the people of the world go to bed hungry at night. They are ill-housed, they are ill-nourished, they are shabbily clad. I've seen it in Latin America, I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia. I remember some years ago, Mrs. King and I journeyed to that great country known as India. I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to meet, talk with the great leaders of India, to meet and talk with and speak to thousands and thousands of people all over that vast country. These experiences will remain dear to me as long as the courts of memory shall live. But I say to you this morning, my friends, that with those depressing moments, how can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry tonight? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes God's children sleeping on the sidewalk at night? In Bombay, more than 1 million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. In Calcutta, more than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population, more than 500 million people, some 480 million, make an annual income of less than $90 a year. Most of them have never seen a doctor or a dentist. As I notice these things, something within me cried out, can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no. Because the destiny of the United States.
Kodiak cakes after an intense workout. It's a great way to refuel your body while still keeping your macros in balance.
Tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation, and I started thinking of the fact that we spend in America millions of dollars a day to store surplus food, and I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge. Drink of stomach for the millions of God's children all over the world go to bed hungry at night. Maybe we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. Not only do we see poverty abroad, I would remind you, in our own nation, there are about 40 million people who are poverty-stricken. I have seen them here and there. I've seen them in the ghettos of the North. I've seen them in the rural areas of the South. I've seen them in Appalachia. I've just been in the process of touring many areas of our country. And I must confess that in some situations, I literally found myself crying. I was in Marks, Mississippi the other day, which is in Quitman County, poorest county in the United States. I tell you, hundreds of little black girls walking the streets with no shoes to wear. I saw their mothers and their fathers trying to carry on a Head Start program, but they had no money. The federal government hadn't funded them. They were trying to carry on, and they raised a little money here and there, trying to get a little food to feed the children, trying to teach them a little something. I saw mothers and fathers who said to me, not only were they unemployed, they didn't get any kind of income, no old age pension, no welfare check or anything. I said, how do you live? They said, well, we go around to the neighbors and ask them for a little something. When the berry season comes, we berry. When the rabbit season comes, we hunt and catch up with rabbits. That's about it. I was in Newark in Harlem just this week. And I walked in to the homes of welfare mothers. Conditions, no, not with wall-to-wall carpet, but wall-to-wall rats and roaches. I stood in an apartment. His welfare mother said to me, the landlord will not repair this place. I've been here 2 years. You made a single repair. Pointed out a little boy who was a victim of lead poisoning. She pointed out the walls with all of the ceiling falling through. She showed me the holes where the rats came in. She said, night after night, we have to stay awake. Keep the rats and the roaches from getting to the children. I said, how much do you pay for this apartment? She said, $125. I looked and I thought and said to myself, it isn't worth $60. Poor people are forced to pay more for less. Living in conditions day in and day out where the whole area is constantly drained without being replenished, it becomes a kind of domestic colony. The tragedy is so awful. These 40 million people are invisible because America is so affluent, so rich, because our expressways carry us away from the devil. We don't see the poor. Jesus told a parable one day, and he reminded us that a man went to hell because he didn't see the poor. His name was Dives. He was a rich man. There was a man by the name of Lazarus, who was a poor man, but not only was he poor, he was sick. Sores were all over his body. He was so weak that he could hardly move. He managed to get to the gate of Dives every day, wanting just to have the crumb that would fall from his table. Dives did nothing about it. The parable ends saying, Dives went to hell, and there was a fixed gulf now between Lazarus and Dives. That is nothing in that parable which says that Dives went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a rich young ruler came to him, and he advised him to sell all. But in that instance, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. And if you will look at that parable with all of its symbolism, you will remember that a conversation took place between heaven and hell, and on the other end of that long distance call between heaven and hell was Abraham in heaven, talking to Dives in hell. Now, Abraham was a very rich man. If you go back to the Old Testament, you see that he was the richest man of his day, so it was not a rich man in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Dives didn't go to hell because he was rich. Dives didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. Dives went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Dives went to hell because he maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. Indeed, Dives went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. This can happen to America, the richest nation in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America's opportunity. Help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. The question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. The real question is whether we have the will. In a few weeks, some of us are coming to Washington to see if the will is still alive, or if it is alive in this nation. We're coming to Washington in a poor people's campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're going to bring those who have known long years of neglect. We're going to bring those who come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit.
I was down to talk to my doctor about Rybelsus. Ask your healthcare provider about Rybelsus today.
Fine. We're going to bring children and adults and old people, people who've never seen a doctor or dentist in their lives. We're not coming to engage in any histrionic gesture. We're not coming to pass Washington. We are coming to demand that the government will address itself to the problem of poverty. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty, possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. We are coming to ask America to be true to the huge promise of Orinoco that it signed years ago. We're coming to engage in dramatic, non-violent action. All attention to the gulf between promise and fulfillment. To make the invisible visible. Why do we do it this way? We do it this way because it is our experience that the nation doesn't move around questions of genuine equality for the poor and for black people till it is confronted massively, dramatically, in terms of direct action. Documents are here to tell us something should be done. We met here some years ago in the White House Conference on Civil Rights, and we do have the same recommendations we will be demanding in our campaign here, but nothing has been done. The President's Commission on Technology, Automation, and Economic Progress recommended these things some time ago. Nothing has been done. Even the Urban Coalition made up of mayors of most cities of our country. The leading businessmen have said that these things should be done. Nothing has been done. Turner Commission came out with its report just a few days ago, then made specific recommendations. Nothing has been done. And I submit that nothing will be done until people of goodwill put their bodies and their souls in motion. It will be the kind of soul force brought into being as a result of this confrontation that I believe will make the difference. Yes, it will be a poor people's campaign. This is a question facing America. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. America has not met its obligations and its responsibilities, the poor. One day, we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done. Yes, we will be able to say, we built gargantuan bridges to span the seas. We built gigantic buildings to kiss the sky. Yes, we made our submarines to penetrate oceanic depths. We brought into being many other things with our scientific and technological power. It seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough. I was hungry, and ye fed me not. I was naked, and ye clothed me not. I was devoid of a decent sanitary house to live in, and ye provided no shelter for me. And consequently, you cannot enter the kingdom of Satan. Do it unto the least of these, my brethren. Ye do it unto me. That's the question facing America today. And I want to say one other challenge that we face. Find an alternative to war and bloodshed. Anyone who feels, and there are still a lot of people who feel that way, that war can solve the social problems facing mankind, is sleeping through a revolution. President Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. The world must hear this. I pray God that America will hear this before it is too late, because today we are fighting a war. I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world. Our involvement in the war in Vietnam has torn up the Geneva Accord to strengthen the military-industrial complex. It has strengthened the forces of reaction in our nation. It has put us against the self-determination of these people. It put us in a position of protecting a corrupt team that is stacked against the poor. They'd have our domestic destiny. This day we are spending $500,000 to kill every Vietnam soldier. Every time we kill one, we spend about $500,000, while we spend only $53 a year for every person characterized as poverty-stricken in the so-called poverty program, which is not even a good skirmish against poverty. Not only that, it has put us in a position of appearing to the world as an arrogant nation. Here we are 10,000 miles away from home, fighting for the so-called freedom of the Vietnamese people. We've not even put our own house in order. We force young black men and young white men to fight and kill in brutal solidarity. Yet when they come back home, they can't hardly live on the same block together. Judgment of God is upon us today. We could go right down the line and see that something must be done. Something must be done quickly. We have alienated ourselves from other nations, so we end up morally and politically isolated in the world. We have not a single major ally of the United States of America that would dare send troops to Vietnam, and so the only friends that we have now are a few client nations like Taiwan, Thailand, South Korea, and a few others. This is where we are. Mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. And the best way to start is to put an end to the war in Vietnam, because it continues. We will inevitably come to the point of confronting China, which could lead the whole world to nuclear annihilation. It's no longer the choice, my friends, between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence, and the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat would be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not imagine. This is why I felt the need, raising my voice against that wall.